Did you do it? Don't do that. You'll be allowed again. Sorry. All rise. Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. The Wisconsin Supreme Court is now in session. The Honorable Chief Justice Annette Kingsland Ziegler presiding. Your silence is commanded.
All right, please be seated.
Amen. Hallelujah.
Got a front
Try not to
seat.
Drop anything.
All right, this morning, the case is Priorities USA versus Wisconsin Elections Commission. It is 24 AP 164. Let me start with appearances, starting with David Fox.
Good morning,
Okay, great. Thank you. Aaron Daly?
Excuse me.
And do we have a All right, the lineup I have for you is 10 minutes, 10 minutes, 5 minutes. Is that correct? Okay. All right. All right, and you have 30 minutes. 5 minutes on Attorney Fox, correct? I just like to make sure we're all on the same page in that regard before we even begin anything. All right, with that said, I would like to acknowledge the students we have here today. We have a number of school groups, and some are perhaps here. Some are in the hearing room, a different hearing room, and they're able to watch the proceedings in there. Fox Valley Technical College, are you in this room? Go ahead and stand up so we can just say hello to you. All right, good morning. It's nice to have you here. All right, go ahead and have a seat. Monticello High School, are you here? Great to have you here also today. Welcome to the Wisconsin Supreme Court. New Glarus High School. All right, go ahead and stand up just like everybody else. All right, nice to have you here. And Wanakee High School. Wow. All right, then. You're here. It's nice to have you here this morning as well. Welcome to the school groups. You are part of Court with Class. They study the cases. They come to court, and they're able to see the Supreme Court in action, and counsel argue their case. And then afterwards, I think it's Justice Protasevich that's going to meet with you. If you have any questions, you can ask her your questions. Not about the case, because she can't talk about that. But she can talk to you about pretty much anything else you can conjure up to want to ask. So think of some good questions for her. She likes to be challenged, and I like it when she is challenged. So that's good. Go ahead and have a seat. Welcome. Nice to have you here. So back to the case at hand. Priorities versus Wisconsin Elections Commission. Attorney Fox, you're first.
Good morning, and may it please the court. The court should overrule Tigan's holding that Wisconsin Statute Section 6.874B1 prohibits municipal clerks from using secure drop boxes to accept completed absentee ballots from voters. Tigan read a restriction into the statute that simply is not there, and in doing so, made it harder for municipal clerks to carry out their duties and for Wisconsin voters to return their ballots for no adequate legal reason.
How is Tigan unworkable?
It is unworkable, Your Honor, because it provides too little guidance on exactly what is not permitted for municipal clerks and voters. And that's true in two respects. First of all, there are two separate rationales in Tigan, and the court's decision is unclear as to which of them or both of them are the governing rationale. There's a rationale that requires the return of the ballot to be to the clerk's office specifically, and there's a rationale that requires it to be to the clerk in a person-to-person transaction. Those are two different rationales based on different portions of the statutes, and they imply different things about what is and is not permissible. One of them suggests it has to be at the clerk's office, but it could be perhaps to an unmanned drop box in the clerk's office. One of them suggests it has to be person to person, but it could be perhaps to a manned drop box elsewhere. That does not give clerks sufficient guidance on what they can and cannot do.
Counsel, the Tegan was a challenge to guidance documents, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
So, I mean, this court wouldn't be prescribing some detailed prescriptions about where you need to do what in a challenge to a guidance document. Our question in Tegan was whether the guidance document was lawful, which didn't require us to provide detailed guidance about where to do things, did it?
Your Honor, I think that that's a fair explanation for why Tegan addressed it in the way that it addressed it, but it still does not overcome the problem that clerks who are trying to do their jobs and voters who are trying to do their jobs need to know what they can and cannot do.
Perhaps, but it's a little odd to say you need to overrule the precedent because we decided the case before us and didn't decide other issues that weren't before us.
Well, Your Honor, particularly because of Section 6.84, which if a statute is contravened, contravention is the term in that statute, provides that a ballot cannot be counted. It is very important for clerks and voters to know what the statutes in fact require. And so the court, yes, it invalidated the guidance documents, but of course it also wrote two opinions, Your Honor's concurrence and the plurality opinion, which had reasoning for why the court did that. And those opinions do not provide a single clear explanation that would allow a clerk to predict what will and will not be allowed. And that is a significant problem.
Just I want to just follow up on the nature of this case. So this case comes before us on a motion to dismiss. What I understood in your argument here in the circuit court is that these were facial constitutional challenges. Is that correct?
That's correct. Our primary claim in the circuit court was, because of course the circuit court could not hear a request to overrule Tegan. So our primary claim in the circuit court was that if taking Tegan as a given, although we did include an argument that it was wrongly decided and should be overruled, but taking it as a given, it led to constitutional problems.
I get that, but here's the problem. We take cases where somebody's been injured. Who's injured by not having drop boxes? I'm trying to understand the nature of how this case even gets here from a standing perspective. Tegan was a pretty clear guidance document case. We had some disagreements over how and whether we can address the lawfulness of guidance documents. But here you just have a voter who, from my understanding, you're arguing it's unconstitutional to not have drop boxes as a method of returning absentee ballots. And that I don't understand at all, and I don't understand how you'd have standing or an injury that this court would be seeking to redress.
So, Your Honor, with respect, I think that the standing inquiry is more straightforward in this case than in the Tegan case, because here we have voters and organizations that have members and constituents for whom the Tegan decision makes it harder for them to return their ballots.
So, hold on. So are you making a constitutional argument or not?
Well, Your Honor, in front of this court, under the court's bypass order, I am not permitted to make a constitutional argument. The court's order granting bypass restricted the arguments we can make to the statutory argument under Tegan, so that is the argument that we're making in front of this court.
But your claim in the circuit court was a facial challenge to the statute as construed in Tegan, correct?
As well as an argument that the court should overrule Tegan on statutory grounds.
But you wouldn't be able to raise that argument unless you were injured. So how is your client, you're just arguing that you're injured by not having that method, injured because of what? Because of the Constitution? Because of what?
We're injured because it makes it harder for our clients to carry out their constitutional right to vote in this state.
So does anybody who argues that voting is harder get to challenge any election or law that they don't like?
If a law makes it illegally, if a practice makes it illegally harder for a voter to cast their ballot, then yes, our position would be that voter is aggrieved and they have standing under Wisconsin's standing approach. Absolutely.
So making it harder is unworkable.
Your Honor, the unworkability analysis under the stare decisis, I think, is distinct from the standing analysis that I was addressing with Justice Hagedorn. It's not just that it makes it harder to vote that makes Tegan unworkable. It is the disparate rationales that I was discussing before, as well as the fact that by abandoning a textualist approach to statutory interpretation and reading into a statute a restriction that is not there, it deprived municipal clerks and voters of the ability to predict whether they are or are not complying with the law. And that is extraordinarily problematic and unworkable in the context of 6.842.
What evidence have you presented to this court of the unworkability of Tegan?
Your Honor, this case is in front of the court on a motion to dismiss, so the record is limited. The municipal clerks filed an amicus brief that addresses their view of the unworkability of Tegan in practice. In addition, much of the unworkability argument that I've just described is a legal argument. It is about, as a matter of law, what Teagan does and does not provide to municipal clerks in terms of what they can do, and what it does and does not tell voters in terms of what they can do.
You've argued that municipal clerks are free to decide where and how they would accept delivery of returned absentee ballots. So it sounds like the holding you're looking for from this court is not restricted to the use of drop boxes. So what limiting principle are you offering the court? Or are you suggesting that under what is supposed to be a heavily regulated regime of absentee voting, because the law in the state of Wisconsin is that there is a right to vote, but there is not a right to vote absentee. That is a privilege that was granted legislatively under the law. So is it your argument, you're asking this court to give municipal clerks absolutely free rein to disregard the carefully regulated regime established by the people's representatives in the legislature, and they can do whatever they want as long as it's workable?
That is not what we're asking. What we are asking the court to do is to apply the statute as written, and the statute as written does not restrict how municipal clerks may accept delivery of voted and sealed absentee ballots.
But the statute as written also does not permit the use of what is colloquially referred to as drop boxes.
So our position is that the statute does permit the use of drop boxes.
Where in the text, because I know your arguments are very focused on the text, where in the text does it reference drop boxes or anything like a drop box?
The statute does not expressly refer to drop boxes, but it requires voters to return ballots to the municipal clerk, and it does not restrict the manner in which that can be done. And our position is that given that, Section 7.15A allows municipal clerks the discretion and indeed gives them the duty to conduct whatever they need to do to properly conduct elections, and that is their authority.
So you would not have us give any effect to Section 6.84(1), which says the legislature finds that voting is a constitutional right, the vigorous exercise of which should be strongly encouraged. In contrast, voting by absentee ballot is a privilege exercised wholly outside the traditional safeguards of the polling place. The legislature finds that the privilege of voting by absentee ballot must be carefully regulated to prevent the potential for fraud or abuse, to prevent overzealous solicitation of absent electors who may prefer not to participate in an election, to prevent undue influence on an absent elector to vote for or against a candidate, or to cast a particular vote in a referendum, or other similar abuses. You would have us just disregard that statement of legislative policy that is actually in the text of the statute?
No, we would not, Your Honor, but Section 6.84 should be read as a whole. Section 6.84, subsection 1, provides a legislative explanation for both the enactments that they have provided regarding absentee ballots and for subsection 2 of that provision, which prescribes a very specific consequence to be taken from that statement of policy, which is that those statutes that are listed shall be construed as mandatory. Not shall be construed strictly in general, not shall be construed to make absentee voting harder, shall be construed as mandatory. What that addresses is the consequences of a violation. It does not address the substance of what those statutes demand.
There's actually nothing in the text of the statute, you have conceded this, that provides for voting by Dropbox.
There is nothing, the word Dropbox does not appear in these statutes.
Anything like it, anywhere in the text.
So again,
unmanned receptacle to receive ballots, anything.
There's the word Dropbox or a synonym for Dropbox does not appear in the statute. But the
is
statute,
there anything like Dropbox?
Well, the statute authorizes clerks to accept the ballots in any way. It does not regulate the manner in which they accept the ballots.
Okay, so Council, so what is the restriction? An unsecured bag? A cardboard box? A van that goes around picking up ballots? What is the limiting principle of what you're asking this court to hold?
So first of all, there's no evidence that in 2020 where drop boxes were heavily used, there was any problem with that. Municipal clerks are public officials. They're accountable to their voters. They're charged with
but
properly conducting elections.
But that's not the issue, Council. The issue is what the law provides for. That's the issue.
I see my light is on.
Your light is on, but we're going to permit a little extra time today. I know Justice Krofsky's been trying to get in. So
I'm done with have an answer to my question. That's my last question.
I also have been trying to get in.
All right. Justice Krofsky, I heard you next.
Yeah, no, it's fine. Is Justice Rebecca Bradley?
I'm just waiting for an answer, and then I have no more questions.
I apologize, Justice Bradley. I was not clear on what your question is. Could you repeat it by any chance? I understood. I heard your statement. I did not hear what the question was.
My question is, what is the limiting principle? Okay, you've conceded that there is no mention in the statute of drop boxes, but the holding that I understand you're asking for would not be restricted to drop boxes. You are asking this court to recognize somehow in the law that municipal clerks can receive absentee ballots in any fashion that they deem acceptable. My question for you is, what is the limiting principle?
So the limiting principle ultimately is Section 7.15A, which allows municipal clerks the duty to properly conduct elections. And if a voter thinks a municipal clerk is violating that duty, they can bring a 5.06 complaint to WEC, and WEC will adjudicate that complaint. And ultimately, that, along with the fact that municipal clerks are accountable to voters in their municipalities, is the limiting principle.
Okay. Justice Karofsky?
Thanks, Chief. I just want to go back to 6.84, which is the legislative policy section that Justice Rebecca Bradley was asking you about. And I just want to go talk about the last, I guess it's the last sentence. Some might call it a run-on, but I won't, since there's a couple of semicolons in there. But at any rate, the statute says, it does talk about the privilege of voting by absentee, and then it says it must be carefully regulated to prevent the potential for fraud or abuse. Do you know of any fraud or abuse that was reported in the 2020 election due to ballot drop boxes?
There's absolutely no evidence that there was any fraud or abuse in 2020 due to ballot drop boxes, and if anything, all of the evidence suggests, and the municipal clerk's amicus brief agrees, that the drop boxes are more secure than the alternatives.
It also says, the next phrase in that long sentence says, to prevent overzealous solicitation of absent electors who may prefer not to participate in an election. Do you know of any evidence from the 2020 campaign where there was evidence of overzealousness of the solicitation of absent electors who did not want to participate in the election, who were forced to, I guess, do so and vote via a ballot drop box?
No, I'm not aware of any such evidence, and there was none mentioned in the Tigan opinion.
The third phrase of that long sentence says that we are to prevent that the rules around absentee voting is to prevent undue influence on an absent elector or vote for or against a candidate or to cast a particular vote in a referendum. Do you know of any evidence that anyone in the 2020 election, we had the use of ballot drop boxes in the state of Wisconsin, that came under undue influence and was, again, I assume the verb would be forced, to vote for or against a candidate or to cast a particular vote in a referendum because of the ballot drop box?
No, I'm not.
And lastly, the last phrase of that long sentence says, or other similar abuses. Do you know of any evidence from the 2020 election when ballot drop boxes were used in the state of Wisconsin quite widely of any other similar abuses due to the use of ballot drop boxes?
No, I'm not.
Thank you. Thank you, Chief.
Counsel, as you know, stare decisis requires not just that an opinion is wrong, but it requires something more than that in its analysis, and you've addressed the question about how is it unworkable in practice. I want to address the unsound in principle aspect of the analysis. In your briefing, you make reference to 6.84 and also reference the skeptical gloss that the majority has in Tegan presented on the absentee balloting that we're addressing here. Can you point to any specific instances in the Tegan majority where their view of 6.84 has so permeated the analysis to a degree that it is unsound in principle?
So yes, I think so. And in particular, the majority relied on 6.84 to require an express authorization for drop boxes instead of asking whether drop boxes were consistent with what the statute said. And that approach is, we submit, unsound in principle. Because obviously the statutory scheme is not going to address every particular of the voting process. It's impossible to do that. What color can the clerk's office's walls be? Where can clerk's offices be located? There are many particulars that we would all agree, I hope, the clerks can just decide for themselves. And Tigan does not provide a workable way or a principled way to decide what becomes significant enough that it needs to be supposedly expressly authorized rather than just being consistent with the statutory provisions. And that, I believe, the Tigan majority pulled from 6.84. And it is a tremendous problem because it leaves all election practices open to after-the-fact reexamination by courts, even in the absence of any violation of an express statutory provision. Thank you, Your Honor.
All right, thank you.
I'm going to be really interested to know by the end of this oral argument if it's Tigan or Tegan.
Now I'm starting to wonder.
I know, I am
too. At least
too.
It's not Kalal.
Well, we're going to get to that.
Okay, counsel, I'm going to jump right in while you're standing up. And what I want to talk to you about is whether or not the court lacked information at or around the time that Tegan was decided. You agree that the legislature did not intervene in the Tegan case, is that correct?
I'm sorry, could you, I was adjusting the podium. Can you restate the question?
Let's start with that. Why don't you just make your appearance, and then you have the floor.
Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you. Good morning, Chief Justice Ziegler. My name is Erin Dealey. I represent the governor. May it please the court. Justice Protasiewicz, if you could repeat your question.
Thank you. And I wanted to jump in because I know a lot of us have questions surrounding this case. One of the issues that I found striking and interesting is the analysis of what information this court may have lacked at or around the time of Tegan. And my understanding is that the legislature did not intervene in Tegan, correct?
That is correct.
Is it accurate that our Wisconsin legislature, at or around the time of Tegan, was assuring federal and local courts that Wisconsin law authorized drop boxes?
That is correct, Your Honor.
Is it also accurate that our legislature assured federal and state courts that local elections officials have the discretion to use drop boxes?
That is correct, Your Honor.
Is it also accurate that the legislature promoted drop boxes as both convenient and secure?
Yes, Your Honor.
And finally, is it accurate that at the time of Tegan, the legislature passed a bill about returning ballots to, and I emphasize, the clerk's office and not the clerk?
Yes, Your Honor.
So if we analyze the lacked critical information component in this case, do you think it is possible that if all of this information was presented during Tegan, the analysis could have looked very different? And if so, why?
I do, Your Honor. I think that it is certainly probative or minimally relevant to this court to consider what the legislature considers the proper interpretation of the text to be. I don't think it's controlling. I think what one legislature says of text drafted 100 years ago isn't necessarily controlling, but is certainly relevant and probative of the issue.
And how prevalent were the use of drop boxes prior to the pandemic?
I'm sorry?
How prevalent were the use of drop boxes, if you know, prior to the pandemic?
In the context of the record here before the court, I can speak to the amicus submitted by clerks in this case that demonstrate there are certain offices that relied on drop boxes for decades before the Tigan decision, particularly rural communities.
But we have no evidence in the record substantiating that, quantifying that, or anything like that, correct?
No, Your Honor. Given the particular posture of this case, you do not.
I have a question for you about one of the criticisms that you make of the Tegan majority opinion in its use of the word fairest interpretation. I don't think you are giving that opinion the fairest interpretation. It seems to me that it's kind of a misrepresentation, to be honest with you, of the opinion. It's pretty clear in the context of the opinion that it's not taking the word fair in the sense of some substantive notion of what's fair to voters. It's saying it's the fairest read of the text. It's the most reasonable. That's what the majority opinion was about, and I joined that portion of the majority opinion, and I agreed with that interpretation of the text. I just think it's really important in these kinds of cases to not misrepresent what the opinion is saying. You can disagree with it statutorily, but it feels off to me and inappropriate to make that opinion as somehow taking some, you're just pulling it out of context and making it say something it's just not saying. It feels very it weakens your argument significantly, and I think it's unfair to the opinion of the court. If you think it's wrong statutorily, I get that. Go ahead and make your arguments. But don't make the opinion say something it didn't say.
Understood, Your Honor. If I may clarify our position as to that for your court's consideration. Our issue with the reliance on the term fair in that context was the use of the phrase fairest interpretation in the court's ruling was specifically made and in reference to the interpretation that municipal clerk, which is a defined term in Chapter 5, was intended, or the fairest interpretation of that term was that the statute actually referred to the municipal clerk office. And our position and what we meant to say, Your Honor, is that yes, this court has often considered what is fair or what is common sense or what is a reasonable interpretation, but it has never taken the leap to say that what is fair is to insert an additional word into the text of the statute.
That's fine, but that's not what your argument was. Your argument was it created a brand new canon of construction that imposed substantive notions of fairness. That is what your brief said, and that is absolutely not what the Teagan majority said. Again, disagree with it if you'd like, but I just really don't like the misrepresentation about what the opinion said.
Understood, Your Honor, and my apologies.
So recently the voters passed constitutional amendments in Article 3, Section 7, 1 and 2. Are you familiar with those constitutional amendments?
Yes, Your Honor, I am.
Do those provide limiting principles for your argument at all?
I haven't put thought into that, Your Honor, and I'm afraid I can't answer that question.
You know, it strikes me because that happened, you know, fairly recently, but before these arguments today. And I put this question out to all counsel. I ran out of time with Mr. Fox, but should counsel be given the opportunity to brief the impact, if any, of those constitutional amendments on the arguments being made?
I don't think so, Your Honor. I think that it is of the utmost importance that this court address the unprincipled or the lack of direction to clerks that the Teagan decision left clerks
so
with.
So what limiting principles exist for clerks? I mean, certainly the constitutional amendment would extend to the allowance of any monies or equipment being donated or granted by an individual or non-governmental entity, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
So who paid for the ballot boxes in the past elections?
I do not know, Your Honor. I don't have evidence in the record to point to answer that question.
So, fair enough. Who could pay for ballot boxes or the like receptacle in the scenario which you pose if we adopt your interpretation?
I believe 7.15, Your Honor, expressly permits municipal clerks to acquire equipment necessary to properly conduct elections. I presume it would be secured and purchased through those mechanisms.
So it would have to be governmental funds?
Presumably, but I'm afraid I can't speak directly to the impact of the amendment.
I think that's important to your analysis, isn't it? Because the Constitution prohibits, for example, the clerks from designating, or if they're designated to perform any task in the conduct of a primary election, no one other than them can do it. And if your argument is that the clerks are the ones that have to do this, then the clerks, without any other individual or non-governmental money, would have to fund the receptacle, right?
Yes, Your Honor. And I'm just not familiar with the funding mechanisms of municipal clerks' offices.
Is your argument that this is going to be somehow mandatory, or is your argument that the statutory provision already in place allows for clerks to have drop boxes if they so choose in their municipalities?
Yes, Your Honor, that is our position. Our position is that
I just want to make sure there's agreement that it can't be some outside force funding, for example, ballot boxes.
And I'm afraid I'm not prepared or equipped to answer the question about what the effect that a constitutional amendment would be on the securing of absentee ballot drop boxes.
Well, what does it say? I mean, it says only a clerk can perform the clerk's duties, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
And it says you can't have outside money or non-governmental money funding that, right? So, I mean, you can't be arguing that somehow someone else could fund ballot boxes. Are you arguing that?
I mean, that is certainly not our position, Your Honor. Our position is that drop boxes can be secured under or are permitted and authorized under 7.15, and 7.15 also expressly permits clerks to obtain and secure and purchase equipment necessary for conducting elections. And this is, of course, not mandatory. It's not required. What the source of that funding is, in the past, I presume, I would hate to presume.
And isn't this not in the record at all about who funds this?
Correct.
Well, there's not a lot in the record since it started here, unlike other cases that develop a record below. So we're stuck with what we've got. But what I hear people talk about are past elections and ballot boxes. And at least some people have the perception those were funded by an outside source, okay? So I'm just trying to make sure you're not here before this court somehow arguing that a non-governmental entity can fund ballot boxes in Wisconsin.
No, Your Honor, that is not a component of our argument. I see my yellow light is on, and there is one point that I'd really like to get to before my time runs out, and that is particularly the practical impact of the Tigan decision. And I think that it is played out in some of the amicus briefs. In particular, the Tigan decision simultaneously seemed to It did affirm a circuit court order that sanctioned staff drop boxes. My red light is on. May I conclude my point, Your Honor?
Please do.
Thank you. It, at the same time, seemed to include language that any drop boxes would be unlawful at all. So there is a highly restrictive read of Tigan that is available, and there is a more permissive read of Tigan that is available. The amicus briefs submitted by the RNC and Will specifically seem to espouse the more restrictive read of Tigan. And I think this is demonstrative of the problem with the Tigan decision, which is that these mixed interpretations of what clerks can do is an outstanding question, and that it is one thing to say that drop boxes are unlawful and another thing to leave unanswered for clerks the question of how precisely they can accept ballots. And that is a question that we urge the court to consider, and we urge the court to answer in the affirmative that drop boxes are lawful. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning, Madam Chief Justice, and may it please the Court. The Commission fully agrees that drop boxes are permitted under Wisconsin statutes, and we'd like to discuss two further points. First, Section 6.84 tells clerks and voters how strictly certain procedures must be complied with. It's not an interpretive rule for courts to decide what those statutes mean. Second, the litigation filed since Tigan and that relies on its methodology has created unreasonable results for clerks.
Counsel, in your brief, you are arguing that Section 687 sub 4 sub B sub 1's language, quote, permits the clerk to devise sensible, safe methods for voters to return their ballots, including through secure receptacles like drop boxes, end quote. My question for you is, what limits are there on what municipal clerks may choose? Why are they limited to choosing only sensible or safe methods of returning ballots? There's absolutely no mention of that in the text, right?
So municipal clerks have an independent statutory duty to conduct elections that are proper and secure, and that comes from Section 7.15. It comes from a subsection of 7.15 that makes clerks, they have a duty to report election irregularities. Municipal clerks are bound by all other Wisconsin election statutes, so they can devise tools to conduct elections, but they can't contravene any statutes.
So you don't think that the legislature has already specified the safe and secure means by which absentee balloting may be conducted? You think that the municipal clerks can add on to the statute?
The municipal clerks can devise tools for their communities to conduct proper elections, so long as it is not prohibited by statute.
So you would not give effect to Section 6.84's statement of policy, which, again, is textual. We're supposed to just ignore that and ignore the carefully regulated regime that the legislature, again, the people's representatives in state government, have have constructed for the privilege of absentee balloting?
The policy statement of 6.84 serves to explain why the legislature adopted a mandatory compliance rule for certain absentee ballots. So it's an explanation for why it departed from the default rule in elections law, which is that substantial compliance is okay as long as a voter substantially complies with in-person voting procedures, their ballot can still count. 6.84 creates an exception to that rule that applies to all other election statutes that says mandatory compliance is required. So even if an absentee voter returns their ballot 1 minute too late on election day, it doesn't count.
And when 6.84 talks about being carefully regulated, is that talking about the courts regulating them, or is that something that the legislature is intended to be doing?
It's an explanation for what the legislature did.
So if the legislature wants to put in additional regulations surrounding drop boxes, for example, that's something that they could do and something that the clerks would then be bound by, right?
Yes.
But the logical extension of your argument, as Justice Dowlett has framed it, is that if the legislature thought it permissible for people to vote by Dropbox or some other means, they would have specified it, right? The argument cuts both ways.
Wisconsin election statutes give clerks authority to implement ways to conduct proper elections in their communities, and they make hundreds of decisions in every election about how best to do so.
So you don't think the legislature has carefully regulated how ballots may be submitted to the municipal clerks, and anything goes? I mean, that's what I'm hearing from the arguments on this side against Teagan. The argument is basically whatever the municipal clerk deems to be safe and secure is okay under the law, which means what? What are the limits? That's the same question I asked your friend on the same side.
Yes, and I would point to Section 7.15. Clerks can be criminally liable for election fraud. That's in 12.13.
But no one's suggesting that municipal clerks are going to participate in a fraud. This case is not about that, okay? What it's about is, or it should be about, is what the law provides for. So there's no point, if we accept your argument, there is absolutely no point to the legislature having enacted all of these statutes specifying in great detail how the privilege of absentee balloting may be effectuated.
I see that my red light is on, but could I answer?
Go ahead and answer, yes.
Okay. the mandatory procedures that are referred to in 6.84 refer to specified procedures. So it is not an overall license to treat absentee voting and absentee ballots differently or more strictly. It only applies to the certain procedures that are enumerated and referenced.
By who? Procedure, I'm sorry, I just want the end of the answer. Procedures
that are referenced in 6.84. Does that?
So they have to use the procedures in 6.84, nothing mm-hmm. that they determine. They have to use what's in 6.84.
So
I'm fine with that.
Yes.
That's what Teagan says.
So that's what 6.84 says. It lists certain enumerated absentee ballot procedures that the mandatory compliance applies to. And apart from that.
So if it's not enumerated, it wouldn't be something that needed to be complied with, but it could be enumerated by the legislature.
It wouldn't require mandatory compliance, so you would not be able to throw out a ballot.
And just to be clear, there's nothing in the statutes that says that drop boxes are unauthorized or illegal, correct?
That's correct.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Misha Zaitlin for the legislature. 2 years ago, this court held over a spirited dissent that Wisconsin law did not authorize clerks to use so-called drop boxes, which was a COVID-19 era innovation where clerks would set up off-site ballot collection receptacles. I've stood at this podium in front of this court on Zoom on location. I've heard the justice of this court talk to me how important they think stare decisis is. If stare decisis is to have absolutely remaining any meaning in this court, it must mean that a decision rendered 2 years ago on the meaning of a statute where no factual or legal developments have occurred, where absolutely no new arguments have been raised, must be adhered to, even if the majority of this court
Mr. Saitlin, I'm glad that you're starting with stare decisis, because I am struggling with it. And I want to read to you a sentence from Justice Alito's opinion in Dobbs versus Whole Women's Health. And this is what he wrote about stare decisis. He said, stare decisis, the doctrine on which Casey's opinion was based, does not compel unending adherence to Roe's abuse of judicial authority. Roe was egregiously wrong from the start. Its reasoning was exceptionally weak, and the decision has had damaging consequences. What are we to do here if we believe that Teagan was egregiously wrong from the start, that its reasoning was exceptionally weak, and that the decision has had damaging consequences?
A couple of things, Your Honor. One is, of course, Dobbs and Roe were constitutional cases. It's firmly established in this court's case law and the Supreme Court's case law. When you have statutory...
We're talking about stare decisis. I understand the difference between constitutional and legislative, and I'm looking forward to talking to you more about that, especially your cite to footnote 18 in the Lynch decision. But this notion that a decision is egregiously wrong from the start, that its reasoning was exceptionally weak, that the decision has had damaging consequences. I see this as check, check, check here. So what are we to do?
Well, let me start in reverse order with regard to damaging consequences. There's absolutely no evidence before the court, competent evidence of any negative consequences that have resulted, that there has been any problem administering elections in 2022. Now, in terms of it being egregiously wrong, you know, Justice Hagedorn said in his concurring opinion, these are difficult questions. Reasonable minds can differ. When we look at the Buchvar case from the Pennsylvania Supreme Court, which was a very similar statute where the Pennsylvania Supreme Court adopted reasoning that was similar to the dissent, and there was a dissent in that case that was similar to majority here, what the Justice of the Pennsylvania Supreme Court said, these are reasonable disagreements because drop boxes are not specifically spelled out in the statute. It's a new innovation. So I think a fair respect to one's colleagues and to reasonable arguments on the other side would not term it a disagreement that occurred in Teagan, some egregious misapplication. It's a reasonable disagreement among justices of good faith who can read a statute that doesn't say drop boxes explicitly one way or the other and can take different approaches. The Pennsylvania Supreme Court said that ambiguity there because of canons of construction that they have in Pennsylvania.
I don't think they had the same language in their statute as we do, and I don't think they had the same Teagan decision which says, you know, to the clerk. Right?
I think it was the exact same language, almost word for word, and I think my friend cited it for that reason. In their brief, they say, look, this kind of language has appeared in other statutes, including Pennsylvania. Look, Pennsylvania went the other way. Fair enough. That's a point on their favor. But Pennsylvania Supreme Court also said it's a reasonable disagreement. And I think it is a reasonable disagreement because the statute says to the clerk, there is the strongest argument on the side of the dissent is that there's other places in the statutes where it says to the clerk's office. The strongest argument the other way is that when the legislature wants to provide for the clerk to be able to have the option of doing something off-site, they specifically provide that option, and they didn't do it with drop boxes. So it's a reasonable disagreement between justices of good faith. And when we have that, you know, with the Supreme Court, U.S. Supreme Court, what Justice Kagan said in the Kimball decision, which is the same language that this court used in the Ramshek case, is that when this court, the highest court, decides what a statute means, that becomes effectively part of the statutory scheme. So we talk about what the legislature can do. The legislature can go ahead and overrule Teagan if it wants by statute. If this court decides to basically take the Teagan majority and make it the dissent, take the Teagan dissent, make it a majority, what's going to happen next year or the year after that is, of course, this court can take judicial notice that the court's composition will change. I'm going to move perhaps over here, and we're going to be arguing about drop boxes for a third time.
Same
arguments.
Mr. Seidlin, but isn't there a bigger issue here? Isn't there a bigger issue here? And that is that we operate in the law with a general concept when the legislature writes a statute that things are permitted unless they're forbidden. There is no way, even though our statute books are quite long and there are quite a few of them, that it could possibly ever encompass every tiny little thing that ever existed in any realm, especially in election law, when we have a decentralized system of clerks, as was already stated, making hundreds of decisions every single day with respect to elections. Teigen, the principle of it, or Teigen, is that somehow if something is not explicitly stated in the statute, that it can't be done. Isn't that that principle? That's the principle that turns everything else on its head. That's the part that has nothing to do with who's in charge of what body, who's on the court. Isn't that the principle that I hear the other side arguing is what is unsound here? And that would lead to a conclusion that is untenable in the law.
The way I read Teigen, there's been multiple pronunciations, is it used 6.84, 6.855 as contextual support for adjudicating what is a true ambiguity in the statute. These offside drop boxes, this is a new innovation. Now, we've had a language like to the clerk in our statutes for a century.
Well, you can see drop boxes have been used for decades, correct?
Absolutely not, Your Honor. The offside drop box, as far as even the clerks in their amicus say, are a COVID-19 innovation. What they're talking about is slots in the sides of clerks' offices, which is a completely different issue, not at all adjudicated in Teigen. The actual, in Wisconsin.
I'm not sure that's true. I'm not sure that's true, because it seems to me that any delivery system to the clerk was at issue in Teigen.
I strongly disagree with that, Your Honor. But in any event, if you look at the clerk's amicus brief, if you look at pages 9 and 10, what they say is the slots in the side of buildings predate COVID. But they do not say in the next sentence, they say the offsite drop boxes, which is what was authorized by the memos that were the causes belli in Teigen, are a COVID-19 innovation. And Justice Berkowitz, I'd like to address your comments about the legislature's prior statements, if I may.
You may.
So I think
before you do that, counsel, that came up in the Teigen litigation. The court was well aware of it. Not that it really matters for purposes of statutory interpretation.
That was the first thing I was going to say. Our position, while we did not participate in Teigen, our positions were noted. And I think it's instructive to see the legislature's position when it was in 2020 versus where it is now versus where this court was in 2022 versus it is now. In 2020, the draw boxes were brand new. We were making those statements in the context of cases dealing completely different things, and as far as I know, no one had even questioned the legality of drop boxes. So
when you said, Mr. Seidlin, when referring to the drop boxes, we wholeheartedly support voters' use of any of these convenient, secure, and expressly authorized absentee ballot return methods that you now say are not such, and that you also said that the Democracy in the Park, which is at issue there, appears to fall outside of these lawful categories. I mean, you were calling drop boxes lawful and expressly authorized. What did you mean by that?
Generally, Your Honor, when one hears new arguments and learns new analyses, one doesn't just say, I'm not changing my mind. So we were, at that point, no one had even criticized drop boxes' legality at that point. Then Teigen came along, and the issues were fully aired. This court, in contrast, heard every single argument that you're hearing today in Teigen. Every single one. There has been no new arguments. It's once in a while you have stare decisis, even statutory decisis.
All right, and I want to talk to you a little bit about stare decisis, counsel. I've got a whole list of cases where you urged this court, either in oral arguments or in briefing, to depart from stare decisis. We can go through them if you want me to. But why, then, is stare decisis so critically unique in this particular case as compared to, let's say, Bartlett v. Evers Tetra Tech, State v. Denny. Tell me the difference.
All right, so I'll do it. With regard to Bartlett and Tetra Tech, those were, so Bartlett was a constitutional case, so that, you know, it was about vetoes, so that can't be overturned legislatively. It's, I think, universally established.
Well, Denny had to do with interpretation of a statute.
Absolutely, and I think that's a perfect example in that of what I was just talking about with legislature statements. What had happened in Denny, and I remember discussing this with you up in Bayfield, Justice Bradley, is in Denny, this court had issued a decision, and because it had been, the issue that it had decided was only mentioned in short supplemental briefs, the both parties had just literally missed subsection 12 of the provision, of the statutory provision. Subsection 12 was not mentioned anywhere in any of the supplemental briefs. As far as I knew, no justice or litigant knew about it. So when we were reviewing the statute, we're like, oh look, subsection 12. Surely the court, had it known about section 12, wouldn't decide it the same way. And in fact, once we presented section 12 to the court, certain justices that were in the majority in the prior decision changed their vote in Denny. So, taking it here, when the legislature was making those statements in 2020, the issue had not been briefed, it had not been aired, there were asides among disputes about other changes in COVID-19. Having seen the reasoning in Teagan, we now understand the drop boxes are illegal. This court is not in the situation here as it was in Denny. Every single argument that was presented before this court in the briefing and this morning, other than the stare decisis stuff, was fully aired by the very talented counsel that argued at this podium 2 years ago in Teagan.
And that is exactly what happened in the case that you cited. You cite State v. Lynch, a 2016 case, and you cite footnote 18 at least two or three times. I might have missed at least two, but I think it was three times. And you want that proposition, you want footnote 18 in Lynch to stand for the proposition that stare decisis is something that this court must always follow, that we must always follow former precedent. And you missed the whole, it's a really long footnote. Like footnote 18 could have been an opinion in and of itself. But it starts out with talking about Kimball, which you've talked about. But then this is what that footnote goes on to say. The Supreme Court of the United States has overruled precedent when the precedential case was badly reasoned. When governing decisions are unworkable or badly reasoned, the court has never felt constrained to follow precedent. The doctrine of stare decisis, of course, is essential to respect accord to the judgments of the court and the stability of the law. But this is in italics. It does not compel us to follow a past decision when its rationale no longer withstands careful analysis. Footnote 18 goes on. It says, beyond workability, the relevant factors in deciding whether to adhere to the principle of stare decisis include the antiquity of the precedent, the reliance state interests at stake, and of course, whether the decision was well reasoned. And noting that the precedential opinion there they were talking about 2 decades old. Here they're saying this was a cite to Citizens United. They said that prior to Citizens United, that the preceding opinion was only 2 decades old as opposed to 2 years old in this case. And that was eliminating that would not upset expectations. My point is that you are talking to us about the importance of precedent, and I think it's very important. I think stability in the law is very, very important. But the truth of it is that sometimes, and if you don't have all the facts, you know, that can be important too, but that's not what this all stood for, right? In Teagan, what if we just got it wrong? What if we made a mistake? Are we now supposed to just perpetuate that mistake into the future? Because the U.S. Supreme Court, from what I can tell, from footnote 18, which you cited two or three times in your brief, says, no, we should not do that.
No, Your Honor, just to be clear, this court has held over and over again, including in Johnson Controls, which is the landmark case, that just because an opinion was wrongly decided is not a sufficient basis. That's clear as day. So you need a special justification. Because, of course, if the opinion is correctly decided, we're not even talking about stare decisis. The only time stare decisis matters is when you think the court got it wrong previously, because otherwise you don't talk about stare decisis. You just you just go along with what was said. And there are certainly, there are good reasons that stare decisis can be overturned. Changed circumstances. Those are usually new laws, new facts. There are no new laws developed, no new facts have been presented to this court. Another one, and I think this is the Denny case, is that if there was just, this court just didn't receive adequate briefing. There were things that were not put up before this court, and if they had been put before this court, the court would have reached a different decision. I am not aware of any other statutory case in this court's history or in the U.S. Supreme Court's history where there were no new legal arguments presented, no factual developments presented, and no claim that laws changed, and yet the meaning of a statute was changed. What this court said is that when this court decides the meaning of a statute, it effectively becomes part of the statutory scheme. What Justice Kagan said for the U.S. Supreme Court in Kimball is when that kind of thing happens, when the court decides that a statute means the baton is passed to the legislature can change what it means.
Is that a damaging consequence that the number of votes that, according to the briefing, in the 2022 general election, which was conducted without drop boxes, over 1,600 absentee ballots arrived at the clerk's office after Election Day in 2022 and thus were not accepted. And in contrast, only 689 ballots arrived at the clerk's office after Election Day in 2020, despite nearly three times as many Wisconsin voters casting absentee ballots.
That's the exact same delta as between 2018 and 2020 that this court had before in Teagan. So when you have the exact same numbers replicated, that's not new facts. That's literally the exact same facts.
How about the bigger issue that I was talking to you about before, Mr. Thielen? How about the fact that this Teagan now, or Teagan stands for the proposition now, at least in election law, if it's left alone and embraced as stare decisis, that if you that the legislature no longer has to put in the statute those carefully regulated things to discuss in 6.84, they just have to say, if it's not in there, it must not be permitted, which is totally contrary to any other area of the law. What about that damage? What about the unsoundness of that principle?
The way I read Teagan, and I think this is the correct reading of Teagan, is that 6.84 and 6.855 are used as contextual support for the proposition that to the clerk is best read to the clerk's office. That's how I read it. Now, there's a disagreement between the majority and the dissent on that, but I can guarantee you that if the dissent in Teagan becomes the majority in this case, that when the court's composition changes in a year, the new dissenters are going to think the majority's decision was unsound in principle under this new "we just disagree" standard, and we're going to be back here again determining whether, as a statutory matter, drop boxes are allowed. And maybe the court's composition will flip the next year, and we'll be back here the fourth time arguing about whether
Counsel, can you address the principle that Justice Dallet is suggesting was newly created in Teagan? You cite a case from 1930, State v. Kohler, and you quote, "The power to prescribe the manner of conducting elections is clearly within the province of the legislature." I wrote Teagan. I think it's really an extension of that principle. Could you address that argument that we created some new principle in election law? I don't think we did.
There was no new principle of election law. The problem that Teagan was facing is that "to the clerk" is an ambiguous phrase, which is just what the Pennsylvania Supreme Court said, taking the same thing. And so in order to determine what the meaning of an ambiguous phrase is, you look at contextual clues. And because the principle is ultimately the legislature gets to decide. And the two contextual clues that were the most powerful in Teagan and that are most powerful here is 6.84, which has what you're talking about, and 6.855.
Do either of those talk, does 6.84 say anything about the municipal clerk at all? That's right? It's just a general principle that...
I think the fairest reading of it is that the legislature is saying when you have absentee voting, that is outside the traditional safeguards of in-person voting. So we're more skeptical of it. So then when you look at an ambiguous phrase like to the clerk, so if I may, Your Honor.
Okay, go ahead, finish.
If you look at an ambiguous phrase to the clerk, you can read it one of two ways. You can read it in the way that it's been understood for a century, which is you got to return it to the clerk's office, or you can look at it in an unlimited way, that is, the clerk can decide for herself where she can accept absentee ballots. She can accept them at her home. She can accept them at the grocery store. She can accept them at lunch at Gray's. And so when you have a legislative text that clearly evidences concern about the lack of traditional safeguards of the polling place of absentee voting, I think it's perfectly legitimate to look at that as one of many contextual clues for the Tekin conclusion.
Counsel, your first sentence, I believe, in your comments today made reference to the, unquote, spirited dissent.
Yes.
You started out strong here, you know. Your arguments seem to suggest with regard to stare decisis, mm-hmm. which is in large part what we're here about, that the traditional tests for stare decisis, are there new facts? Is there a new development in the law? Unworkable in practice, unsound in principle, and reliance. I think of that as a laundry list. It seems to me you're suggesting here today that if there's no new facts and there's no development of law that has changed things, that we're not dealing then with unsound in principle or unworkable in practice.
I think that when we're talking about statutory stare decisis, absent something very unusual, like the Denny situation, you can't, if this court is going to say that unsound in principle means we think we got it really, really wrong, when all the arguments were put before the court, this court should just say statutory decisis is dead. It should just say that. It should not, at least in cases where there was a dissent, because there is no decision ever written in the Wisconsin's history or the Supreme Court's history where there was a spirited dissent, where I couldn't make an argument as that it was somehow unsound in principle because the dissent was so right. And so we're going to be back here, again, we'll be back here in 2 years, you know, when the court's composition changes, we'll be arguing about the meaning of the same statutory text. And in the constitutional context,
you assume a fact, not an evidence.
Oh, yes.
Sorry, Your Honor?
I said you assume a fact, not an evidence in
your Honor,
argument.
Your Honor, I read your press statement.
Nevertheless, you may proceed.
Your court contingent should notice of the announcements of the justice of the case.
Counsel, I wanted to ask about whether the rule that's sort of being proposed on the other side, you know, has not quite yet been tested either in any way. My colleague has asked about some sort of limiting principle. The principle, as I understand it, from your friends on the other side, is basically delivery in person to the municipal clerk means the municipal clerk gets to designate some location quite apart from where the municipal clerk is where they can receive ballots. They've not specified what limits would exist for that, what sorts of creative ways might be deployed. I'm curious if you put some thought into that. You know, and again, I trust that the municipal clerks of this state are people of goodwill who want to follow the law, but we've also seen a lot of creative things happen that creates uncertainty. And just curious if you have any thoughts about their limiting principles, which I'm not hearing, and any of the things that this court might need to be concerned about if, in fact, their views prevail.
I mean, putting aside the consideration of stare decisis, I think this is the most troubling aspect of my friend's submission. When the legislature has spelled out that the absentee balloting activities could be held off-site in 6.855, it has put important constraints in there, important ones like the off-site site has to be as close as possible to the clerk's office, and that it can't be put somewhere that benefits one political party. Those constraints are just simply not in the statute as they read 6.7 sub 4, et cetera. So clerks, theoretically, having no statutory constraint, could put absentee drop boxes in places where those who are politically aligned with the clerk are more likely to be in order to help the preferred candidates. Now, someone can
evidence of that in the record. There is no,
but
correct?
Absolutely.
I just want to be clear.
Well, yes, but the legislature was concerned enough about this with regard to off-site drama. Offsite locations that they specifically prohibited. So obviously, it's
but,
not.
But 6.855 is a different statute, right? 6.855 is the alternate absentee ballot site. That is where you go and you vote, you fill out your ballot, and you return your ballot at one site. That is different than a drop box, correct?
I agree, Your Honor. But what I put to Justice Hagerman, if I may finish, is that. With regard to constraints, the legislature was sufficiently concerned about clerks doing things that benefited certain one political party or another to put
wait,
a constraint
how do you
on.
Wait, where is that anywhere?
No, I mean, that's literally in 6.855. It says you cannot locate an absent. You cannot.
But it does not say because we're afraid that the clerks are gonna somehow try to encourage voters of their political persuasion to come and vote. I mean, you're adding all kinds of things into this statute at this point.
Mr. Seedlin, this was not something you were obviously concerned about at all in 2020 when you said that these boxes were expressly authorized and lawful. Now all of a sudden...
Justice Kavanaugh echoed that and said the same thing.
Sorry, Your Honor?
I think Justice Kavanaugh echoed that and said the same thing regarding ballot drop boxes.
Neither you or Justice Kavanaugh, though, were evaluating, construing the statute in Wisconsin in the context of a case.
At that point, 2020, no one had raised any legal objections to drop boxes. We didn't have any sort of briefing on it. This court did have the briefing in Teigen. This court received every argument it did in Teigen. If this court reaches a different conclusion here, with respect, statutory decisis has no practical meaning in the state.
I appreciate, you know, your comments about some of the ways that, you know, that some of the more creative things that can happen in the statutory things. And one of the things I cited in my concurrence in Teigen was 6.88(1), which seems to prescribe pretty strict sort of rules for chain of custody and those sorts of things. It actually says, when an absentee ballot arrives at the office of the municipal clerk or at an alternate site under 6.855, which at least to my mind suggests there weren't other options for ballots could be received, but that there's some specific, you know, prescriptions for what can happen with the ballots. And it seems to me there may be a gap under your opposing party's views about what to do with the ballots. There is nothing there about how ballots should be secured or about chain of custody or those sorts of things, at least that I'm aware of. It might exist. I'm unaware of it.
Absolutely right, Your Honor. I mean, it's interesting that the memos in Teigen talked about, the WEC memos, talked about secure drop boxes. You know, the cameras are on them, things of that sort. Nothing about their reasoning would require the drop boxes to be secure. And that's not to say that clerks wouldn't take various methods to secure them or not that, but they would not be statutorily mandated, as they would not be statutorily mandated to not put them in a place that benefits one political party or another. And while there might be some offense taken to saying any clerk would do that, the legislature obviously prohibited that very practice with regard to the 6.855 locations because there was concern by the legislature there wouldn't be any other reason to put that provision in the statute.
So the petitioner seemed to be arguing that Section 687.4(b)(1) silently but implicitly delegated authority to municipal clerks to decide how voters should submit their absentee ballots to the municipal clerk. Is there any case that you're aware of where this court overruled a prior decision that authoritatively interpreted a statute on a theory of implied delegation through silence?
I'm not aware of any case like that. And more broadly, I'm not aware of any other case in this court's history that overturned the meaning of a statute based on no new factual or legal developments and no new arguments that were not presented. Maybe there is one like that. My friends haven't pointed it out. And that would be... The price, and I understand that there was very strong disagreement in Teigen about drop boxes. I do not think that, I think that the principle of statutory decisis is too valuable to cash out for drop boxes.
Counsel, I again get back to your emphasis was no new facts, no new law, and seems to then disregard unsound in principle and unworkable in practice as part of the analysis. You go to number one and number two, if you will, and stop there.
In terms of unworkable in practice, while it's not phrased as no new developments, I think that is a kind of new development. That is to say, you issue a decision and that it doesn't work as a practical matter. There's evidence that the decision is not working. And while that's stated as a different for a new law, I think it's a new development. That, you know, we sat with this case for decades, and it just breaks the statute, something like that. With regard to unsigned in principle, it just cannot be a reasonable disagreement between justices of good faith. It has to be something significantly more than that, especially when you're talking about statutory stare decisis, which, as this court has said, effectively becomes part of the statutory scheme. Thank you, Your Honor.
All right, thank you. Bonnie.
Thank you, Your Honor. I want to start with this idea that the reason why my friend on the other side wrote a letter saying Dropboxes were expressly authorized in 2020 was that no one had questioned it. That is exactly the problem. I don't question that representation, but that is exactly the problem.
Why does that matter?
Because
why does it matter at all to reading what the statute says? I mean, that wasn't an issue there. I mean, we've had parties change their positions very recently in this court, and other people haven't been troubled by it. Why does it matter that the legislature takes a different view of the statute for us to read the statute faithfully?
What it shows is that people will not see a problem, clerks will not see a problem, voters will not see a problem, everyone will take action that seems to everyone at the time like a perfectly legitimate action, and then after an election, someone is going to come to this clerk and they're going to say, wait, where's the express authorization? All of those ballots need to be cast out under Section 6.84. And that is exactly, frankly, what the court saw after the 2020 election and thankfully did not do. But it is an enormous problem from this court's decision in Tigan. Because if everything needs to be expressly authorized on pain of discarding ballots, that is a loaded gun.
Where does the decision say that? Could you point me exactly to where Tigan says that unless every single jot and tittle is expressly written, it could never happen. I mean, there certainly is some broad stuff that municipal clerks have been given authority to in all other places, right?
It is Tegan's insistence that because the statute does not refer to drop boxes or expressly authorize them as a third option, that they are therefore unauthorized, is where it says that. And that together with its construction of 6.84. And that's the problem.
But as the legislature pointed out, I mean, I think this is, I mean, it's because it was looking at the statutes as a whole. And again, I understand there's reasonable arguments on the other side that you're making. I understand those, understood those 2 years ago. But it wasn't the case that there was some brand announced principle that you could never do anything unless the statute said jump. It just said the statutes do seem to be pretty specific about where ballots can be received. And this is how we read the statutes.
I mean, with respect, Justice Hagedorn, the statute is very specific about where many things can happen, requiring them to happen specifically at the clerk's office. And it does not say that with respect to the return of
the ballots. The best read of the statutes. And I understand you disagree with that, but that is what Tegan was saying. You can disagree with it, but again, don't make it say something it didn't say.
So, Your Honor, I just disagree that is the basis for the Tigan holding. I understand Your Honor wrote a concurrence in that case and joined much of the majority opinion, but what the opinion says is that because drop boxes were not authorized expressly, they are not allowed. And it relied on 6.84 to reach that conclusion, and that is an enormous problem that threatens future elections in this state. In terms of stare decisis is a framework for the court to apply in deciding whether to overrule a case. It is not an inexorable command that the court can never overrule a case. The question is essentially one of weighing the costs of overruling and the change in the law, which admittedly has substantial costs, against the benefits. And that's exactly what this court said in Johnson Controls. It's just not the case that this court never overrules precedent or even that it never overrules statutory precedent. It happens. It happened, for example, in 2006 in the Bartholomew case, where the court overruled a decision issued just 2 years earlier in the Maupin case. It happens. The court needs to weigh the importance of adhering to settled precedent, especially where parties have relied to their detriment on that precedent.
Did you say what the unworkable, when the workable in practice piece is here? I'm not really understanding the failure to not having drop boxes, which again is how pretty much elections were always run in most places until 2020, these offset drop boxes, that somehow creates a real problem to go to 5 years ago status quo.
The unworkability in practice is primarily the lack of sufficient guidance. So I heard Mr. Saitlin say he's not sure about the slot in the municipal clerk's office and whether that's allowable or not. That is emblematic of the unworkability in practice, because ballots we know from the municipal clerks are being deposited in those slots in current elections.
Counsel, as Justice Hagedorn pointed out earlier, this court does not exist to provide guidance Okay, we don't issue advisory opinions. We declare what the law says. That's it. And as I understand your argument, you are asking this court to become a super legislature and give free rein, despite what the statutes say, give free rein to municipal clerks to conduct elections however they see fit. That, counsel, seems to me to be the greater danger to democracy, because you are asking this court to override what the legislature wrote.
We are not. We are asking the court to apply the statutes that the legislature wrote according to the text of those statutes and this court's settled approach to stare decisis and statutory interpretation.
Elections occurred after Teigen, right?
Yes.
In Wisconsin. What was the problem?
Your Honor, the elections in 2022, I mean, one problem is that more absentee ballots were discarded as arriving too late in 2022 than in 2020. But in addition, the court has seen, and the Wisconsin courts have seen, a substantial amount of litigation seizing on the rulings and statements in Teigen as a basis for challenging other practices that similarly are not contrary to an express statute, but also are not expressly authorized. And the court will continue to see more and more of that litigation if it adheres to that principle. And so that is a new fact.
So why did you wait till now to bring this lawsuit instead of bringing it before those elections?
Your Honor, we brought this lawsuit when we brought the lawsuit because of concerns about the way the law was developing in the state of Wisconsin with respect to elections. It was after some of these other decisions had been filed. It was after some of these concerns had been raised. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. All right. The court is adjourned from the oral arguments this morning. We will convene in closed conference at 1:30, and Justice Protasiewicz, she'll meet with the students.
Beth, thank you.
All right, thank you.
I'm going to escort you off.
Oh, good.
Make sure you find your way. Like your Google Maps.
Good.